You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
We continue on a Tuesday. Secretary of Defense was in Washington, D.C. recently, taking a break from globe-trotting, as he does. And he went to the Association of the United States Army, and which is a big deal. They have a big exposition, all kinds of new technology rolled out there, and a big convention. It's gigantor. Anyway, you can imagine how big it is if a Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff speak at an event. Okay, it's not your basic gathering of Apache Company 3rd Light Armored Reconnaissance Battalion. Okay, it's a little bit more. So we're going to hear that right now. This is where last week the interview came from, where he said told the Army to be ready to go to Korea. So not an insignificant speech that he gave. So without further ado, it's about 30 minutes. So stand by. Targets. That the applause is for the Secretary of Defense.
Thank you. Thanks very much, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you, General Hamm, old friend of many years. It's an absolute delight to be here with you all. And I do appreciate being invited to something like this. I can probably find no place in Washington, D.C. today that I feel more at home than here amongst all of you.
Wait a minute. How about 8th and I? Headquarters Marine Corps? All right. Now he's selling.
Acting Secretary McCarthy, we first met each other in those very uncertain days after 9/11 in Afghanistan, and we've served together for many years after that. Thank you for coming back to the colors, sir. It's a pleasure to serve with you once again. General Milley, we've served together. We know each other over many years. You have the DNA of Iwo Jima in your veins. You bleed red, white, and blue, and the Army could not be in better hands right now. Sergeant Major Daley, Besides deciding to go out on the obstacle course this morning, that Army 10-miler yesterday, I guess, was just your warm-up for it this morning. So in the truest traditions of Army NCOs, where you lead from up front and put yourself in difficult circumstances voluntarily, thank you for your leadership as well. After that presentation, I'm going down to the recruiting office. After that, I'm going to sign up for another 40 years, I guarantee you. But it was also something to remind us about the priorities that Secretary McCarthy, General Milley have made very clear in their time in office, and that is for readiness. And we will talk more about that. But I'm going to be very pleased to take some questions at the end of this. And so let's see if I can close the gap between a Secretary of Defense and all of you out there for a little bit.
Let me just interject here. What's really interesting is when you see shots of the crowd, enthusiastic to have him there and to have him as the Secretary of Defense. He is a charismatic, has a reputation as a no-nonsense warfighter. Now, I know people that don't care for General Mattis, okay? But his effect on the larger community is, I don't want to say magical, but he is a rock star, and you can see it when he goes into these groups. He's looked at as a warfighter. He's looked at as a no-nonsense guy that will, if you don't have your shit together, right, he will throw your carcass right in the middle of the room. And it's interesting to see just the way people respond to it. Very cool.
I would just tell you that I recognize that whatever ranks we wear today or we once wore, in this room we are all co-equal in our devotion to this wonderful magic experiment that we call America, and protecting our people and our Constitution, and we are co-equal, and that is one thing that the American forces have always had in their ranks, a sense of co-equal devotion. So I'm honored to be here with you today, you who hold the line in this world. And I want to mention something about the veterans. In my talks with soldiers on the front lines, I've just returned from Afghanistan a few days ago. The only thing I think they would ever fear is letting down you and the legacy that you bequeathed to them. Because they know, based on what you've been through, that they can do the job, because it can be nothing worse than what you faced in your most difficult days. And that builds their confidence. And especially from me, on a personal level, a thank you to the Vietnam veterans who stayed in, as we heard in the presentation this morning, stayed in the Army, rebuilt the Army. They were the veterans who raised me in the Marine Corps and made me the Marine I was. So to all veterans, and especially the Vietnam veterans, you have my deepest affection for what you committed to our country. Thank you. Thanks very much. To our Medal of Honor winner and to all of you who have been decorated and recognized for valor in combat, I just want to say to you, in great deeds, something abides. Regardless of which war you earned the respect to your fellow warriors, your example of courage echoes today down through our ranks. To our Gold Star families who join us here today, as General Chamberlain of the 20th Maine said years after the Civil War, we pray daily to be worthy of your sacrifice. Thank you. As your Secretary of Defense, I am honored to join you. I'm grateful to serve once again alongside soldiers of the greatest army, the most trusted army on earth. To serve once again among the disciplined, ethical, capable, high-spirited soldiers whose character I have seen rise to every occasion in the worst possible circumstances. Soldiers who are always at their best when the times are at their worst. Soldiers who General George Washington would be proud of. For 242 years now, you have set the standard. For you are the soldier descendants today of ragged Continentals who left bloody footprints at Valley Forge. You who, from Lexington to Bastogne to the Corringal, generation after generation, you have carried our flag in your hearts and the Patriot's fire in your belly. A fire that keeps alive our experiment that we call America. An experiment to determine if a government of the people, by the people, and for the people can long survive. A united army, united in commitment that stands as a model for our fellow citizens of what Americans who stand united can do. And our Army's ranks today are filled with willing, high-quality patriots, all volunteers. And again, I am very proud to serve with you. The international situation is the most complex and demanding that I have seen in all my years of service, and that's over four decades. In the Mideast, terrorists continue to conduct murder and mayhem despite significant and accelerating losses. One state sponsor of terror in the Mideast cannot hide behind its nation-state status, while in effect it is actually a destabilizing revolutionary regime. In Europe, for the first time since World War II, we've seen national borders changed by the force of arms as one country proves willing to ignore international law to exercise a veto authority over its neighbors' rights to make decisions in the economic, diplomatic, and security domains. In the Pacific, we've seen North Korean provocations threatening regional and even global peace despite universal condemnation by the United Nations. So this is the reality that faces our Department of Defense and our like-minded allies, and we must have militaries fit for their purpose, fit for their time, in these days of emerging challenges. For these challenges include new domains of conflict in space and in cyberspace, and in ways that involve deniable attacks even on our democratic processes. Your Department of Defense is adapting because we do not want to be dominant and at the same time irrelevant. and I offer this problem statement for what must guide our efforts. How do we maintain a safe and effective nuclear deterrent so these weapons are never used and our nonproliferation efforts can be recharged? Second, how to maintain a decisive conventional force at the same time as that nuclear deterrent, one that will include space and cyberspace capability to deter war or end it decisively if conflict occurs. And third, we must at the same time maintain an irregular capability so we can fight across the spectrum of conflict. This is our problem statement, how to maintain a safe and secure nuclear deterrent and maintain a decisive conventional force that can also fight irregular warfare. Our department has three lines of effort to address these issues. First, everything we must do must contribute to the increased lethality of our military. We must never lose sight of the fact that we have no God-given right to victory on the battlefield. Secretary McCarthy and General Milley are examining every personnel policy, our training time, our organization, and more to ensure they contribute to make us the most lethal joint force in the world. Even as our competitive edge over our foes and adversaries decreases due to budgetary confusion in this town and the budget caps, I am among the majority in this country that believes our nation can afford survival, and I want the Congress back in the driver's seat of budget decisions, not in the spectator's seat of automatic cuts. I have great confidence in the U.S. Congress, but I have no confidence in automatic mathematical budget cuts. Second line of effort, we are following the example of the greatest generation coming home from the tragedy of World War II and who looked around and they said, what a crummy world. But we're part of it, whether or not we like it, and we're going to do something about it. And in that spirit, they build alliances and partnerships. In the same spirit today, we are strengthening alliances and building new partnerships, whether it be NATO, the Counter-ISIS Coalition, the 39 nations standing together in Afghanistan, and expanding friend and partner bonds in the Indo-Pacific region. Secretary of State Tillerson's Defeat ISIS Coalition is only one example of what this looks like in practice. 69 nations banded together, plus four international organizations, the Arab League and NATO, the European Union and Interpol, all working in concert to defeat ISIS. But we also stand with our traditional allies as well as building new coalitions as we work together to defend our values. And to our allies here in this room today, I will tell you I had the honor of fighting many times for America. I never once fought in an all-American or solely American formation. It was always alongside allies. And I will just tell you, from NATO in Europe to the Pacific, the message to our allies is we are with you. Under Deputy Secretary of Defense Shanahan, our new Deputy Secretary and full of vigor, under him lies most of the continued effort for line of effort number three, and that is the keen direction that he is helping to provide Secretary McCarthy and his fellow appointees to rework our business practices to gain full benefit from every dollar spent on defense. We are taking aggressive action to reform the way we do business and to gain and to hold the trust of the Congress and the American people that we are responsible stewards of the money allocated to us, and that it translates directly every dollar into the defense of our country and what we stand for. In all of this, the Army's importance is absolutely fundamental. Historian T.R. Fehrenbach once wrote, "You may fly over a nation forever, you may bomb it, atomize it, pulverize it, and wipe it clean of life, but if you desire to defend it, if you desire to protect it, if you desire to keep it for civilization, you must do this on the ground the way the Roman legions did, by putting your young men in the mud. I would only modify it today by by putting your young men and women in the mud. And this is why the Army is so critical to our nation's security. I have by now grown rather remote from so many of you who man the ramparts, those of you who have looked past the hot political rhetoric to rally to our flag in the age of our high-quality, all-volunteer force. Yet while I no longer have the opportunity to get to know you personally, I do know your character. You could get out of the Army and make more money. You could get out of the Army and see more of your families. You could do any number of things, but you have the habit of putting others first, of putting your country first. At Antietam Battlefield Cemetery, the statue of a lone soldier stands atop a pillar, looking out across the graves of his fallen comrades. He's a private, and he is nicknamed Old Isaac, and it is inscribed on the pillar he stands above, quote, "not for themselves, but for their country." Whether you spend a few years in your youth in the U.S. Army, ladies and gentlemen, or grow gray in the service to our beloved nation and its Constitution, rest assured you will always look back on the sacrifices of war, the demands of sergeants, and the frustrations of unpredictable deployments as the best years of your young lives. And even those of us denied the opportunity by our ranks to stand physically beside you every day, nonetheless, we join your fellow citizens in humbled awe of your willingness to sign a blank check payable to the American people, a blank check payable with your lives, to defend our revolutionary ideas enshrined in our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution, putting freedom above all else. Now, if you want to know where I see modern war trending, I just ask that you reread General Milley's remarks from a year ago at this very convention. If you want a reminder of war's primitive, atavistic, and unrelenting nature, reread Fehrenbach's This Kind of War. If you want to see why I believe command and feedback must supplement our approach to command and control, read Rules of the Game by Gordon. If you want to know where I come from in terms of strategy, read The Future of Strategy by Colin Gray, the most near-faultless strategist alive today. And most importantly, when it comes to you willing and magnificent soldiers, those who from General George Washington to today carry our hopes on your shoulders, I say that you need only follow the Army Creed we just all saw on the screen and recited. We need you at the top of your game in body, mind, and spirit. Physically, I salute Generals Milley and Frost's initiative to toughen the physical standards that they now have underway for the U.S. Army. I'm reminded that General Schwarzkopf, in the years after Vietnam, served under a Korean War veteran when he was a battalion commander, a brigade commander who insisted on tougher soldiers knowing what he had faced in the Korean War. Mentally, I want you to enhance your warfighting skills, assuming every week in the Army is a week to get better at integrating all Army and joint efforts to become more tactically cunning. So body and mind must be matched with the spirit. And spiritually, ladies and gentlemen, we need our soldiers to build your own and your comrades in arms resilience to take combat tests of your character in stride in the most primitive environment on earth. Let me close with a reminder to today's troops through our veterans' eyes. I want to go back to World War II, the greatest generation. Today, as we sit here, there is a 91-year-old World War II combat veteran from Maine. The veteran is Mr. Richard Lincoln, and he's now living in a veteran's home in Maine. He and his three brothers all fought in World War II, and he is the last surviving one. Mr. Lincoln has a remarkable story. As a 17-year-old from a very small town of Wayne, Maine, town of less than 1,000 people, and standing just 5'5" tall, I wondered as I read that, was that the effects of malnutrition during the Depression? Mr. Lincoln served as a first scout in the 88th Infantry Division in the Battle of Anzio, which, as you all know, was a grueling and historically important amphibious assault in the Italian campaign, an amphibious landing against long odds, which permitted the Allied capture of Rome. He repeatedly risked his life on the front lines to identify enemy artillery batteries, regularly enduring enemy fire and never shrinking from enormous dangers. The 88th became the first draftee division to enter a combat zone in World War II. In 344 days of combat, the 88th Infantry Division lost 2,298 men killed in action and 9,225 men wounded. The Blue Devils, as they were called, proved that with rigorous training, sound teamwork, competent leadership, and fierce determination, an all-draftee division was more than capable of fighting well against well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened enemy. When the Allies liberated Rome on June 4th, everyone wanted to be the first into Rome, but the all-draftee 88th became the first division to enter the city. Although overshadowed by the Normandy invasion 2 days later, you all know the capture of Rome was a significant victory for the Allies. For his heroic service in that campaign, Mr. Lincoln was awarded the Bronze Star Medal, and on June 4, 1944, the day when he and his fellow soldiers of the 88th Infantry Division entered Rome, Richard Lincoln turned 18 years old. Mr. Lincoln was and is today a humble, earnest, self-effacing man, grateful to be an American. He knows what it felt like to be shot at from very close range every day for months, since being a scout was about as close to the front lines as it gets. To this day, he wonders how he survived when so many comrades did not. He says he thinks it might have been because I was short, which is a wise point. I never envied tall men on the battlefield myself. But I would tell you, too, that Mr. Lincoln is one of those who created the legacy of the American Army, the most trusted, the most ethical, the most capable army in the world, one built on physically tough and tactically competent soldiers under NCOs and officers at the top of their grim game. From Shiloh to the Marne, from the Bulge to Porkchop Hill, the Delta, and the deserts that this generation of soldiers have faced, when trouble loomed, the Army has always stood and delivered. So to all the veterans in the room, you set an uncompromising bar that every one of us on duty today must live up to. We know we will never face something worse than what you maintained your dignity and your honor throughout. So to every veteran in this room, to every Mr. Lincoln who's hailed from Maine to Hawaii, from Alaska to Puerto Rico, thank you for standing by the red, white, and blue. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for having me here. May I take your questions?
All right, this is the Secretary of Defense, obviously, speaking to the a convention in Washington, D.C., the Association of the United States Army, at their big convention. So, obviously, he the keynote speaker, and on the undercard is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That you'll hear him momentarily as well. That was a speech. He's now doing a Q&A. If you haven't read This Kind of War by Fehrenbach, which he quotes here, read it. Pretty amazing.
Well, thanks very much, Mr. Secretary. We took the liberty of collecting some questions from our members and others, and appreciate you taking time to answer just a few. So the first one is, we just saw a program that highlighted how the Army expanded and transformed quickly 100 years ago to meet the demands of World War I. What insights from World War I seem most relevant to you as the Army faces challenges today?
Well, I appreciate the presentation earlier, because whenever you look back at history, you realize that while technology may change, we really face nothing new under the sun. And we oftentimes come up with good ideas in old books and reading history. I think the message I was thinking as I watched that presentation was the need for readiness. There was a comrade by the name of John Abizade, who is a younger general, once said to me, you know, if you were sitting in my chair, and he was in the joint staff in those days, in 1810, and you said, where are we going to fight in the next 10 years? Not one of us would have guessed. I think the Royal Navy is going to sail right up that river outside my window and burn this town to the ground. Well, you say that's a long time ago. He says, think about 1910. How many would have said that we're going to be in Europe in the next 10 years? And the U.S. Army, strung out from forts all across the Indian fighting West, would never have forecast they'd be wearing gas masks with airplanes dropping bombs and charging machine guns and barbed wire. So the need for readiness must also ensure that we have a shock absorber built inside the Army. And out of World War I, where the first advance we made, the first offensive we made, went horribly wrong because troops couldn't get to the front lines in the right order, there was a traffic jam, the attack went in badly. It's a reminder we've got to be brilliant in the basics of blocking and tackling. Because from Bataan Peninsula to Kasserine Pass to Task Force Smith, we know too well the costs of not being ready. And I think that right now what we want to do is be so ready and be very much aware that we fight the way we come, that everybody in the world wants to deal with Secretary Tillerson and the Department of State, not the Department of Defense and the United States Army.
Mr. Secretary, you mentioned Congress in your remarks, so this question is related to that, I think, in a follow-up. How can the American public and industry, and I'll add, the Association of the United States Army and like-minded associations, how can those groups influence Congress to fulfill its constitutional responsibility to provide for the common defense?
Ladies and gentlemen, I think what is probably most important right now is we lay out the problem in compelling and persuasive terms. Go back to Einstein's point many, many years ago when asked how he would compose his thoughts if he was given 1 hour to save the world. And he said, I'd spend 55 minutes defining the problem and I'd save the world in 5 minutes. Now, there are times when those of us who wear the uniform can be rightly condemned for being overly conservative, wanting more insurance and more boats and planes and guns and tanks. And I understand that. And as General MacArthur said when he was Chief of Staff of the Army, in those days when our country was having difficult times economically before World War II, and he was trying to convince the U.S. Congress to spend an adequate amount of money on readiness so that the U.S. Army would be ready. He made the point there that day that we have got to be willing to do this because it's the surest way to deter war, but there's also a time and a cost aspect to this. And I think the more we can explain, we have the time right now to prepare for war as the best way to prevent war. But should conflict break out, to get money later will not be good enough because we won't have the time at that point. And we all understand this. But I think the more we explain persuasively, objectively, what is the situation in this increasingly complex security environment, that many of our most legendary statesmen alive today, from Dr. Kissinger to George Shultz to Sam Nunn to all the others who have looked at this over decades, Dr. William Perry, former Secretary of Defense, Senator Cohen, former Secretary of Defense. If we can lay this out, the problem out in compelling terms, I believe in the U.S. Congress. I believe in them 100%. But we've got to lay this out in such a way that in a democracy we bring the American people with us. And that starts with the U.S. Congress. So we need everyone to make certain that we're laying out the problem in a manner that leaves no doubt about the need for what we're asking for in order to ensure that America's Army is at the top of its game. Thank you.
Sir, if you got time, sir, for two more.
Absolutely.
So several questions about acquisition. I'll condense a couple of them. What can be done to enhance responsiveness to warfighter needs? And a follow-on to that, what can be done to incentivize collaboration amongst the services, other U.S. government agencies, and our allies?
Well, the first thing is, I know, having spoken with Secretary McCarthy, that he's got a process underway with General Milley to take the best aspects of rapid equipping and institutionalizing it as the way we do acquisition in the U.S. Army. But there's a point in the second question about how do we get the joint force, like how do we get the department like this? And I think the most important thing is, one, communications, and two, the actual organization of the department. At Congress's direction, one which I completely embrace, we are going to break acquisition, technology, and logistics into research and engineering on the one hand, and then into acquisition and sustainment on the other. The intention here is that we move faster in research and engineering. I've lived out in Silicon Valley for the 3 years that I was retired, and I've seen what American industry is capable of from Silicon Valley to Michigan, from Boston to Texas, and we have got to open the communication with them much more robustly. Now, lawyers, I love lawyers. I don't want my daughter to marry one, but I love lawyers, okay? But at the same time, lawyers give advice, and I want the DOD lawyers to keep us strictly within the legal and ethical codes that we must live by when we handle the amounts of money and the government taxpayers' money. But I also want to remember that corporations are made up of Americans, too, and I want open communications, no favoritism, no violations of law, no violations of ethics. But I want no longer this gulf between us to deny us the very advances that American industry is out there and executing for themselves in the private sector, the advances in weaponry that are out there right now. And in some countries, our advantage is being eroded as they move more swiftly, going back to Secretary McCarthy and now Secretary Shanahan, Deputy Secretary of Defense, and their initiatives to move us more rapidly and organize to move more rapidly. As much as processes bore all of us to tears, if we don't get this acquisition process right, you can throw the best people in the world at it, and 9 times out of 10, a bad process is going to win. So we've got to straighten out the process, and I've brought people in from industry to be right now. Ellen Lord is the acquisition technology and logistics person and actually overseeing the breaking apart of that into what Congress has directed. Deputy Secretary Shanahan comes from American industry. He's seen it at its best in a highly competitive industry. We've got people in there who know what they're doing. It's time to roll our sleeves up and get on with it.
Last one, sir. Unsurprisingly, about Korea. And I suspect you're probably not going to reveal to us the intricate details of your Korea strategy. But what can the U.S. military do to lessen the likelihood of conflict on the Korean Peninsula?
Well, what a great question. Let me talk about Korea for a minute because it's on all of our minds. And you know there's a reason that I recommended T.R. Fehrenbach's book, that we all pull it out and read it one more time. But, ladies and gentlemen, it is right now a diplomatically led, economic sanctioned, buttressed effort to try to turn North Korea off this path. Now, what does the future hold? Neither you nor I can say. So there's one thing the U.S. Army can do, and that is you have got to be ready to ensure that we have military options, that our president can employ if needed. We currently are in a diplomatically led effort. And how many times have you seen the UN Security Council vote unanimously, now twice in a row, to impose stronger sanctions on North Korea? And remember, the Security Council has countries like France and Russia, China, the United States. You know who's on there. And all voted unanimously on this. The international community has spoken, but that means the U.S. Army must stand ready. And so if you're ready, that's your duty at this point in time. And I know the Army will always do its duty. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for having me here. Have a great conference. And to our allies, thank you for being here.
And that was the news. The largest news headline was how he answered the last question of this whole speech, and that was when he told the Army to be ready and how you can help be ready. And so, honestly, if you're listening to this and you're part of the operating forces, the things he specifically talked about relative to the Army was higher physical standards. And I'll tell you what, you can hear in his message, you'll hear the shapings of what will be his message to the United States Navy. And as the Navy begins to deal with their issues. And they won't be a whole lot different than what you heard right here. We're going to take about a 60-second break, and then we're going to come back, and you're going to hear from the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joe Dunford. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
All right. The Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff spoke after the Secretary of Defense spoke at this conference. So stand by. Target.
Hey, thanks, Carter, for that introduction, and I would tell you, as the former deputy J3 when General Hamm was the J3, Carter, everything you said about me, it must have been mirror imaging, because that's what I would say about you. But more importantly, I'm actually pretty proud to stand up here and say I'm Hamm trained. But if you think you're a little bit uncomfortable at lunch today, wait till tomorrow morning. General Milley, Chief, the Army's lucky to have you at the helm, and I feel fortunate to have you as a partner on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You're the right leader at the right time. And General Sullivan, the pride of Quincy, Massachusetts. There you go. You know, I'm going to just say something that I hadn't really thought about until I arrived today and had a chance to talk to General Sullivan beforehand. And I've seen so many of the distinguished former chiefs here and in Army leadership. And this is really directed at the active duty people that are here. If you're looking for an example of how to conduct yourself when you're a retired general officer, if you're looking for a way to continue to serve, if you're looking for a way to continue to enhance the credibility of our institution, you just have to look at the way General Gordon Sullivan has conducted himself for not just his almost 40 years in active duty, but the 10 or 15 years that he's been continuing to serve our Army since he retired. And if you want to know what right looks like when you retire, and again, I'm speaking to those still wearing a uniform, that's what right looks like. And to all the soldiers in the room, thanks for what you do. There are a number of friends here, and I could probably eat up the 20 minutes that I've been given just by going around the room and mentioning them by name, and I won't do that. Before I begin, though, I do want to once again congratulate Marilyn for her recognition. She outlined pretty well the challenges that face us. And I know that one of the things that this week is all about is developing a better relationship, a closer relationship between the services, in this case our Army, and in industry. And frankly, I think at this particular time, again, another model, what Marilyn has done at Lockheed Martin, and I know this from a previous life as a service chief, has been exactly that, is to try to develop a good relationship. We're all going to live on a fixed income. I'll talk a little bit more about that. And that means we got to make the right choices. That means we have to have a shared understanding of the challenges that face us. That means we have to have a shared understanding of what our soldiers need to be successful. And I think what Lockheed Martin is doing in that regard is a model. So well-deserved recognition, Marilyn, for you. I am honored to be here today, and I mean that sincerely, and I'm honored every day to represent our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. It's the best part of what I do. And this afternoon, what I thought I would do is just share with you a few thoughts about how I see the strategic landscape right now, but more importantly, the implications for the joint force of that strategic landscape. And along the way, I think I'll probably make a few comments about the implications of the strategic landscape today for our Army as well. I had the opportunity to read some of the coverage of the speakers earlier this week and some of the dialogue that's taken place, and I think that what I'm about to say is complementary to much of the conversation that you've had Monday and Tuesday and earlier this morning. Before I do that, I want to talk about readiness, and the Chief is absolutely right to make readiness his number one priority. Our Army and our Joint Force has to be ready to fight and win across the spectrum of conflict. And we've learned from history that crisis and contingency are typically a come-as-you-are affair. General Sullivan frequently reminded us of that when he was the Chief of Staff of the Army. And you remember he talked about Task Force Smith quite a bit when he was the Chief. When the North Korean People's Army charged across the 38th parallel in June of 1950, and shortly thereafter, we were fighting on the ground, in a place, at a time, under conditions we simply didn't expect. And I think we all remember the initial results of that were disastrous. I like to remind people who have a high confidence about assumptions on when, where, and how we'll fight the next fight. I like to remind them that the Korean War took place right after some of the best strategists that we've ever produced as a nation decided to rebalance to Europe. That's what assumptions can do. And we know the cost to soldiers when we get it wrong. We know the cost to soldiers when we're not ready. 7 hours after Task Force Smith made contact, 185 soldiers were dead, wounded, or missing. Among other things, they could have used the 3.5-inch rocket launchers to stop the North Korean tanks. They had 2.36 rocket launchers, and that's because all the 3.5-inch rocket launchers that were in inventory were going to where we actually needed them, in Europe. So when we gather in venues like this or articulate our requirement for resources on the Hill, like the Chiefs recently did before the Senate Armed Services Committee, I think it's absolutely appropriate that we're candid. And I'm going to fully associate myself with General Milley's comments last 2 weeks ago before the Senate Armed Services Committee and the comments made by the other Chiefs. That said, and something very important that I'd like to say, is that your Army, the Joint Force, remains the most capable professional force in the world. We can defend the nation and protect our way of life. We can meet our alliance responsibilities And we have a competitive advantage over any potential adversary in the world. And I think that's an important point that shouldn't be lost on our enemies. It shouldn't be lost on our allies. It shouldn't be lost on the American people. And most importantly, it shouldn't be lost on the men and women in the joint force. I was a platoon commander in the 1970s, and I was a company commander when General Meyer introduced the term hollow army in his testimony in May of 1980. And I would tell you, our joint force today bears no comparison to a hollow army. Not in leadership, not in training, not in equipment, not in the quality of our people. And that's a point of emphasis that I would make, because I wouldn't be, and I want to assure you, I wouldn't be part of anything that would return us back to the kind of force that we had in my early days on active duty. And I'm saying all that in terms of the capability and the credibility of our force today. I'm saying all that fully appreciative of the challenges that each of the services have experienced as a result of fiscal instability and an incredibly high level of operational tempo, 15 years at war. And that's particularly true of the Army, which has been the linchpin of the joint force since 9/11. And I use that word deliberately, linchpin, because the Army has literally been the force that has held together the joint force with critical command and control capabilities, critical logistics capabilities, and other enablers. And when some people use the word foundation, I don't think that actually captures the role of the Army in the joint force. And so I'd offer to you that from my perspective, as I look at it through the lens I look at the services through now, I see it as the linchpin. And I'm not saying that to make you feel good. In any event, we're running hard, and we still have many units today at a one-to-one deployment-to-dwell ratio and sometimes greater, and it's not just Iraq and Afghanistan that are keeping us busy. I was reminded of that recently when Captain Brian Hotchkiss, a company commander with the 3rd Infantry Division, deployed to Juba, South Sudan, to reinforce our diplomatic presence there. I'd met some of his soldiers last Christmas when they were in Djibouti. His company is part of that regionally aligned brigade that's in AFRICOM. His brigade's out of Fort Stewart. They're operating with about 1,300 soldiers in about 14 different countries across the continent. When they go home, they should feel a tremendous sense of satisfaction for the contribution that they've made on two continents during their deployment. I was also reminded of how busy we are when I've met soldiers like Sergeant Major Matt Barrick, and I think he may actually be here today. He's a Special Forces soldier with the 7th Special Forces Group. He's currently training Colombians in both counter-narcotic and human trafficking. In his 19-year career, he's deployed over 20 times to 16 different countries. And I think all of us know that's actually not a unique story in our Army today. As we speak, the Army's got 184,000 soldiers in 140 different countries worldwide. Joe Anderson, is he here, Chief? No, see, he's actually working. He's the G3 of the Army. But he could give you the brief, though. He could talk about soldiers making it matter in Afghanistan. He could talk about soldiers supporting our partners on the ground in Iraq and Syria. Soldiers building relationships and interoperability with our allies and partners in the Pacific and prepared to fight tonight under Vince Brooks' leadership. And soldiers training in the Ukraine while reassuring our allies in deterring Russia. They used to say that the sun never sets on the British Empire. I think it's fair today to say that the sun never sets on the Army of the United States. But that operational tempo has put stress on our people, and particularly on our families. And there's human factor indicators and trends, and the Chief and I have spoken about them. We recognize that they're out there. And we also know our equipment is showing signs of wear and tear. We've exceeded miles on our vehicles, hours on our aircraft, and the readiness challenges have been exacerbated in many cases by significant delays in our modernization programs as a result of tough choices that we've had to make. So my point is, I'm not at all complacent about today's competitive advantage. We do have to restore readiness, and that means recruiting and retaining the right quality people. It means modernizing key systems, delivering rigorous training, revitalizing our infrastructure, and doing something that I think virtually every Army leader this week has spoken about, growing the right leaders that we need for the future. In the end, we have to develop what I describe as comprehensive joint readiness. And the true test for the joint force is our ability to deliver viable and credible options to our national command authority in time of a crisis or a contingency. At the end of the day, that's, to me, the metric of success. We've got to maintain also the flexibility to transition from one crisis to another, and ensure, and I think this is an important point, and it's what makes the United States different, ensure that our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines are never in a fair fight. That's not what we seek to do, is to put our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines in a fair fight. And doing that is going to require some hard choices, there's no doubt. It's going to require that we adapt the force that we have today to meet today's challenges, even as we innovate towards tomorrow. That's been a theme of the conference this week, and quite honestly, it's a theme on the Joint Staff every day. That's our collective responsibility, and with your help, that's actually, for me, job one over the next few years that I'm your chairman. It's been said many times this week that we live in an incredibly complex and dynamic security environment, and someone no less than Henry Kissinger said that this is the most complex and dynamic security environment since World War II. And I got to tell you, after a year in my current assignment, I'm not going to push back on either Henry Kissinger or the other speakers this week. In fact, I was mindful as I was preparing for this of Carlyle. Interesting enough, when I was a student at the Army War College, I was the exercise chairman for one of the exercises in the spring. And during the exercise, they came at us with 5, 6, 7 different scenarios. You know, at one point I put my hands up and I said, this is BS. This is never going to happen this way. Never going to happen this way. I now realize that General Scales and the faculty at the Army War College when I was there lacked imagination. They lacked it. It's all that they provided to me and much, much more. But although the institutions and the structures that have underpinned the international order since World War II are still largely intact, we are confronted simultaneously with 4 state challenges, of course, Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, and 1 non-state challenge in the form of violent extremism. Most of you have heard these referred to as the 4+1. And I just want to share with you what the 4+1 are for me. First of all, it's not predictive in nature. So when I talk about the 4+1, I'm not using that to predict the future. If anything has happened to me in my time on active duty, it's that I have become humble about our ability to predict the future. In fact, you know, when I speak at Capstone, I speak sincerely. I say, you know, when I was a second lieutenant, here was my level of confidence that I had all the answers, and here was my level of experience. And I'm standing before you today, and I say this sincerely. Today, here's my level of confidence that I have all the answers, and here's my level of experience. It's completely inverse. But I have found that the 4+1 is a useful construct to look at the joint force. And here's the assumption I make, and it's really an important assumption, and if I don't have it right, this is something that I need to be challenged on. My assumption is that if we look at the 4 state challenges that we have, and I'll share some of the details of that here in a minute, but if we look at these 4 state challenges and then we look at violent extremism and we look at where they are today and we benchmark ourselves against those challenges today and we look at where they are in terms of their path to capability development 5, 7, 8 years from now and we use that as a benchmark and then we kind of look at how we which would match up against one or more of these challenges simultaneously. Here's the key assumption I make. My assumption is that we'll get it about right. In other words, we will build about the right inventory of joint capabilities and capacities that will allow us to maintain a competitive advantage. We may not find ourselves dealing with any one of those 4 state challenges in the future. It may be a challenge that we completely didn't expect. Again, witness Task Force Smith. But we do need something to benchmark ourselves against. We do need something to drive our assessment of risk today, our risk for tomorrow. We need something to inform the path for capability development that we are pursuing as a joint force. And so that's, to me, what the 4+1 are. And what I'd like to do is I'm going to run through very quickly each of the 4 state challenges in violent extremism just to set the stage for what I really believe the most important part of the conversation, and that is what I see as the implications of these 4+1. The first is Russia, and I've said it many times publicly. The chief has said it. Russia presents the greatest array of challenges and threats to our interests. Despite, you know, they have significant demographic and economic challenges, there's no doubt, but it's equally true that they've been pursuing a path of military capability development and modernization that's virtually unmatched around the world. They're also operating with a frequency in areas that we haven't seen for almost 20 years. When I was a young captain in the Mediterranean aboard Navy ships, routinely we would see Soviets down there operating with the full capabilities of the Soviet Union. We haven't seen that pattern of operational that operational pattern for 20 years. We haven't seen that operational pattern that we see now in the North Sea and the Arctic, but we see it now with Russia. We've also seen them modernizing their existing systems and also some capabilities that are particularly concerning to the United States and our interests, their long-range conventional strike, modernized nuclear capabilities, and then focused on developing a wide range of robust cyber, space, electronic warfare, and undersea capabilities. And they're also doing that while continuing to maintain a very capable conventional force. In my judgment, their operational patterns, their capability development, and their behavior are designed to undermine the United States, our ability to project power, and the credibility of our alliances. We have recently concluded the National Military Strategy. It's about ready to be signed and moved on. I got to give the Secretary a chance to look at it, but the Chiefs and I have built this from the top down. I'll mention it again in a minute. But as we went through this, we struggled with centers of gravity. We said, what is it that we draw our strength from as a joint force? And with apologies to those at the command and staff colleges that say you have to identify one center of gravity, we landed on two. One we said was kind of at the strategic level, and that's the network of alliances and partnerships that we've built up over the last 70 years is absolutely a source of strength for the joint force. And then the other source of strength, which won't surprise you, and we've talked about it much this week. I know Dave Perkins has spoken about it. That's our ability as a nation to project power. And in my judgment, when you look at what Russia is doing, both from a capability development perspective and from a political perspective, and I'll speak a little bit more about that in a minute, I think it's focused on those two areas, undermining the credibility of our alliances and minimizing, mitigating our power projection capability. In the Pacific, you know, our policy is to seek opportunities to cooperate with China. But from a military perspective, we're also watching very closely the militarization of the South China Sea and East China Sea. And we're looking at China's expansion in their presence, both inside of Asia and outside of Asia. And while their budget and their expenditures in particular are relatively opaque, sometimes it's hard to see exactly what the Chinese are doing, either in a fiscal perspective or in terms of capability development, it's pretty clear that the Chinese leadership has embarked on a very significant program to modernize the nuclear enterprise, their power projection, their space, their cyber, ballistic missile, and defense capabilities. And similar to Russia, what I believe is that China seeks to do the same thing in the Pacific that Russia seeks to do, which is undermine the credibility of our alliances and partnerships in the Pacific, while at the same time minimizing our ability to move into the Pacific from a power projection perspective or operate within the Pacific. North Korea's behavior and capability development continues to threaten our allies and, as we've seen recently, potentially the homeland. We've seen the recent efforts to develop cyber, ballistic missile, and nuclear capabilities. And the Iranian regime aims to establish itself as the dominant regional power in the Middle East, and I describe the major export of the Iranians as malign influence as they support terrorist organizations across the region while modernizing an impressive array of maritime, ballistic missile, again, space, cyber, and cruise missile capabilities. And finally, we continue to grapple with the challenge of violent extremism, and that includes the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and associated groups. It is, as we all know, a trans-regional threat, and we're continually developing our ability to disrupt external attacks and enhance our ability to deal with the problem trans-regionally. I don't have time to discuss it today, but over the past year, one of our focuses has been is to try to bring some coherence to all of our regional efforts against violent extremism. And with SOCOM's lead, I think we've come up with a much more effective framework to do that. If you think about it, each of the combatant commanders either is sitting on top of a coalition, in the case of the United States Central Command, that's true, or regional efforts to deal with with the terrorist threat, violent extremism, and you see that from West Africa to Southeast Asia. Our focus now is to try to deal with the trans-regional threat trans-regionally, to prioritize and allocate resources in a global way, and again, to bring some coherence, and I'm particularly appreciative of what SOCOM has done to help us move towards that. Work to do, but we're getting there. Well, we all realize that this is a long-term proposition. I'm pretty encouraged by the progress that we've made on the ground, in Iraq and Syria over the past year. And I would just say parenthetically, and not just because I'm speaking to this crowd, I think we can all be proud of the leadership, starting with James Terry and going on to Sean McFarland and going to Steve Townsend today, in the great force that they have led over the last 2 years. What I have said to people, you know, if we were having last year, if I had been a speaker here at AUSA, and you said, what would you want the situation on the ground to be next year? I don't think I could have asked for something better than what we're seeing right now, the progress that's made over the last year. And again, it isn't just what took place over the past year. It was the foundational work that was done to build partnership capacity, develop the intel network, develop the infrastructure that we are now leveraging to start to push back on the Islamic State. Again, more work needs to be done, and we're no means complacent, but I think we're getting after this permutation of violent extremism pretty well. And frankly, when I look at our efforts in West Africa, in Libya, and under Mick Nicholson's leadership in Afghanistan, I see similar results. But now, you know, to kind of move forward, and the challenges that I see when I look at those four state challenges in violent extremism have a number of implications for the joint force. And the first one is foundational, and that is we need a balanced inventory of capabilities with sufficient capacity that allows us to deter and defeat potential adversaries across the range of military operations. As a nation that has to think and act globally, we don't have the luxury of choosing between a force that can fight ISIL and one that can deter and defeat a peer adversary. Nor do we have the luxury of choosing between meeting our current operational requirements and developing the capabilities we'll need to meet tomorrow. I read General Hamm's article that was published on Monday. I've listened to some of the speakers. That's been a constant theme, the need to balance today's requirements with the need to grow the force that we will need tomorrow. And getting that balance right, in my judgment, will be one of our more significant challenges in the next few years. In this crowd, I don't have to say much about the fiscal environment. The Bipartisan Budget Act may get us through FY17, but we still have $100 billion of sequestration looming, and we've got literally, and we've used this phrase, but it's true, we have a bow wave of modernization requirements that are going to have to be addressed over the next couple of years. And while predictable and sufficient funding are part of the equation, and we need both of those, and both the Chief and I have banged that home many times before the Senate Armed Services Committee and the House Armed Services Committee, we're going to have to do more than buy hardware in the days ahead. We're going to have to expend some intellectual capital and develop disruptive and innovative ways to meet our requirements. And I have come to paraphrase, and I like the expression that Winston Churchill is attributed, it's attributed to Winston Churchill. Ladies and gentlemen, we're out of money. Now it's time to think. A second implication for us to consider is to most effectively use the military and international power to address today's challenges. I believe we need to develop more effective methods to deal with what we've seen of Russian behavior in the Crimea, in Georgia, in the Ukraine, what we've seen of Iranian malign influence across the Middle East, and again, what we've seen of China's activity in the South China Sea and the East China Sea. Each of those nations have leveraged economic coercion, political influence, information operations, unconventional operations, and military posture to advance their national interests. I refer to that, and some use the term hybrid or gray zone. I've specifically not done that because both terms have become laden with baggage. I refer to that as adversarial competition that has a military dimension but falls short of actual armed conflict. So adversarial competition with a military dimension. In our traditional approach is to think about whether we're at peace or at war. And meanwhile, our adversaries don't think about things that way. It's for that reason that I don't actually find the current construct that we have, for example, with operation plans, particularly useful. Again, if you think about shaping and you think about conflict, you would bin all of your activities, your authorities, and your capabilities into one of the bins. You're either shaping or you're fighting. Our adversaries are unconstrained by that methodology. In fact, I can share with you an anecdote. In November of last year, I was in the job about a month, and we had all the combatant commanders convened down at Quantico. We had a large map in a gymnasium to kind of talk about the joint force and frankly how we would prioritize and allocate resources in the event of a specific scenario. And I asked General Phil Breedlove, a good friend for a long time, I said, Phil, what phase are you in right now in Europe? And he looked at me a bit confused and he said, well, we're in phase zero. And I said, all right, what phase would you assess Russia is in right now in Europe? And he said, I don't know, probably phase two or two and a half. And then I asked Admiral Harris the same question. I said, Harry, how about the Chinese? What phase are they in? He said, on a daily basis, we see activities, authorities, capabilities being employed that are probably more closely associated to phase two than phase zero. And then rhetorically, of course, I asked the question, how long can we have our competitors in phase two or two and a half while we remain in phase zero and maintain a competitive edge? I think we also need to develop a framework within which to deter cyber threats. And clearly, many in this room know that some of the challenges include attributing threats, managing escalation, and hardening ourselves against a cyber threat. You know, earlier, and I just make a comment about resilience. Earlier, when I spoke about one of the important deliverables of the joint force being to deliver credible and capable options to the National Command Authority in times of crisis, I have come in this job to look at resilience as an incredibly important thing, because the resilience of the platform from which we project power actually has a lot to do with the options that we're going to be able to provide the National Command Authority in a crisis. And when you think about tools that we can employ, you know, it's very difficult to start thinking aggressively about employing offensive tools if we haven't addressed the foundational elements of defending the network in the event that the enemy responds in kind. And so I would just say that of the areas, there's many areas that would keep all of us awake at night. That issue of resilience, that one example of cyber being one of many, but that issue of resilience is one that I pay attention to. I would just say that one of the more significant implications of the current trends in the security environment is the high likelihood that any future conflict is going to be transregional, multi-domain, and multifunctional. And while multi-domain conflict is by no means new, and I'm not advertising it as such, advances in electronic warfare, information operations, cyber activities, space operations, ballistic missile technology have all made the character of war today extraordinarily dynamic. And we're going to see capabilities like that. We see capabilities like that today fielded by both state and non-state actors, and they know exactly how to employ those tools to exploit our vulnerabilities. You know, about 18 months ago, I had a chance to visit Dave Perkins and H.R. McMaster down at TRADOC, and I've read the Army operating concept, and we spoke about it a lot that day. And I know the Army is getting after this whole idea of multi-domain conflict in a pretty aggressive way at the operational level. What I'd like to do, maybe just share with you through the lens I'm looking at it, is it's a little bit different at the strategic level, but there are some similarities.
This is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in case you don't know, Joe Dunford. He spoke last week and at the U.S. Army Association conference in Washington, D.C. Secretary of Defense also spoke. If you have been with us for the last hour, you heard him before that. But I will tell you this. Joe Dunford's a brilliant guy, and you see it on display here. And he's walking us through what phase is Russia in, what phase are we in, what phase is China in, what phase are we in. China's assessed to be in phase two in the Pacific. We're at phase zero. Russia in phase two, maybe one and a half, someplace in there relative to their use of regular forces, irregular forces, exercise, and all designed to manipulate former satellite republics that inhabit their borders. Where are we? He's just an absolutely brilliant guy, and that's why I love listening to them verbatim in long format. Is something I think that ought to be a requirement.
In my mind, there's some strategic implications with conflicts that are going to quickly spread across multiple combatant commands that are, in fact, multi-domain and multifunctional. And the current fight against violent extremism is just one such example where you see a transregional, multi-domain fight. But the example that I have come to use, because it illustrates it well for me, is the North Korea scenario. And we got General Sharp here and many others who have served in Korea. General Thurman is here. But I use the North Korea threat because it drives home for me the point I'm trying to make. If you think about it, in the 1990s, we had a regional strategy, and I think we had a fundamental assumption that if a conflict broke out in the Korean Peninsula, we could manage that within the region, if not within the Korean Peninsula. And that was certainly our effort with ground forces supported by aviation and maritime forces. But then as North Korea developed ballistic missiles, we start now to involve the platforms from which we project power in the Pacific to include Japan. And that now makes it clearly a regional fight. And then as North Korea develops cyber capabilities, space capabilities, and intercontinental ballistic missiles, now I think I would assume that a conflict in the Korean Peninsula very quickly is not just multi-domain, but it's multi-domain and trans-regional. And so the example I would use is I'd say, look, if a fight breaks out in the peninsula, yes, General Brooks is engaged. Yes, Admiral Harris is engaged, but so is General Robinson in NORTHCOM. So is Admiral Haney at Strategic Command. So is Mike Rogers at Cyber Command. And who for a minute thinks that if something like that happens on the Korean Peninsula, we're going to be able to afford to come to all stop and do student body left over to the Korean Peninsula, that something else won't be going on simultaneously. In the context of that dynamic, I don't believe our planning, our organizational, or our command and control constructs are optimized for the current fight or for the fight that we're going to face in the future.
Wow.
You know, again, today we kind of basically have a regionally focused construct. In an execution, and this is an important point, I think, in execution, and we ought to be proud of this, we rely on cooperation and collaboration across combatant commanders in supporting relationships. And I think that's worked for decades, but my argument is that if you think about that North Korean scenario and you think about simultaneity and you think about violent extremism and all those things happening at the same time, the lowest level of integration from an authority's perspective in the Department of Defense is the Secretary of Defense. And I think he's going to need more support than he currently has to make decisions with those factors of time and space, and again, the character of war as I see it in the 21st century at the strategic level. And for that reason, I mentioned the National Military Strategy earlier. It's a classified document this year, and the reason it is to frame these problems I just spoke about and provide a framework within which we can integrate the joint force from the very beginning. And the one thing I say is the aggregation of operations plans is not a strategy. What we should do is go from policy to a strategic framework for some of these problem sets like Russia and China and Iran and North Korea. That strategic framework then informs combatant commanders' theater campaign plans in their old plans. And we're also working to develop a more effective command and control construct to facilitate decision making. Here's my point. We don't have, you talked mission command this week quite a bit, we don't have mission command today at the strategic level in the United States. More importantly, we haven't set the fundamental conditions that are necessary to establish mission command. And we're getting after that, and I'll have more on that in the coming weeks. Before I close, I just want to quickly shift to the Army specifically and talk about your biggest challenges. And again, I think in the broadest sense, what General Hamm said earlier this week in terms of the balance between today and tomorrow is right on the mark. And from my perspective, the near-term challenge, obviously, is to restore the full-spectrum readiness that the Chief's talked about, even as we meet op-tempo requirements, the combatant commander's requirements. And you're tackling that, and General Milley has rightly made that his number one priority in making progress. And I think I recognize that in the way you've set up your training, the way you've leveraged the Guard and Reserve components, and the way you've prioritized leader development. Again, looking at the remarks that have been made by my predecessors this week, almost every one of them has talked about those areas. I think General Milley would be the first to tell you that progress has come at a cost. And in order to maintain that high level of readiness, we have taken a hiatus on modernization. I think we have accepted risk downstream. And that's why I think the long-term challenge for the Army and really for the entire joint force is to kind of reset that balance. And this is probably one of the key points I wanted to make today. I think if you look back over the last 4 years, we made two assumptions 4 years ago when we were trying to deal with the budget. We assumed that the operational tempo would reduce. Our operational requirements would go down. And we also assumed that the budget situation would get better. I'm here to tell you, as we grapple with the future challenges, I would offer to you that those assumptions have only exacerbated the fiscal challenge we've had. And if I were to make two assumptions today, I'd make them this way. I'd say, number one, I don't believe, there's no indication for me sitting where I sit that our operational requirements are going to be reduced. I don't see that. Nor do I actually see us enjoying an increase in the resources that are going to be available to us. I don't see that. We may avoid sequestration. But if you look at historical trends, I don't see our top line significantly increasing. So I think over the next couple of years, the chief, the secretary, the leadership team that's here, we're going to have to make some pretty tough choices, and he's going to need the whole team to get it right. And I won't give you too much advice today. The first advice I'll give you, and the chief's heard me talk about this before, is we can't afford inside our Army what I describe as the three P's. Being possessive, being parochial, or being pedantic are not going to be helpful over the next couple of years as we deal with these challenges. And we've worked through these as an Army before. There's no doubt about it. And the innovation that we talk about now, the innovation that we need, the kind of thinking that we need, has been the hallmark of the Army for a long time. In the 1920s, we saw it when George Marshall took the lessons learned from World War I and set the conditions for the Army to be successful in World War II. In the 1960s, there was an old cavalryman that worked on cavalry doctrine that really informed the way that we did business in Vietnam. And after Vietnam, and there's a number of them here right now, there was a generation of leaders that rebuilt our Army, rebuilt it from a training perspective, from a capability development perspective, from a doctrine perspective, and as importantly, from a leadership development perspective. And each of these examples has, I think, some common themes. One is combat-tested leaders. Two is they leveraged existing technologies. Three is they worked with industry partners and joint partners, and they adapted the way they think, the way they thought, in order to develop a breakthrough in how we fight. So they changed the way they thought, and it influenced how we fought. But they changed the way we thought, and they influenced how we fought. And I think that really, at the end of the day, is the legacy of innovation in our Army. It's in your DNA, and you're always focused on looking at tomorrow, not yesterday. And I think that's particularly true today, because one of my expressions is, you can be sure as the Army of the United States that you will get no credit tomorrow for what you did yesterday. I'm going to close by telling you that I do recognize the challenges that we have inside the Army. I recognize the challenges that the Chief has outlined in terms of readiness. But I also would say that we still have the best Army in the world, and our job is now to make sure that even as we meet the requirements, the incredible requirements we're putting our Army today, that we have a half an eye towards tomorrow and we're able to do two things at once. They were able to do that in the 1920s. They were able to do that in the late 1950s and 1960s. They were able to do that in the 1980s, and we are equally capable of doing that today. And because I have such confidence in our ability to do that, I just want to tell you that I am incredibly proud to have had the opportunity to be here today at AUSA, proud that my friend General Hamm invited me to be here, but proud every day to wear this uniform alongside those who are in this room and, more importantly, those you represent. God bless you, and thanks very much.
You know, not a lot has been made about that speech right there. That's a big-time speech. His challenge, what he sees, how things need to change, and most of all his two assumptions, that A, operational tempo would slow down, and B, that there would be some relief in terms of the budget, that those two assumptions have been invalid. Assumptions are huge for going future. Wes O'Donnell joined us last week. He sent me an article. United States underspending on defense, as crazy as that is, relative to our gross domestic product, we're underspending on defense. And let me tell you, at some point we're going to pay for it. Very, very interesting speech. We're going to take a quick break, only about a minute or two. The Gunner will join us coming up next.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Wilson, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when the group can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.